The Anton Savage Show Saturday
with Nifty Business on News Talk.
Now, I'm joined by Gabia Gadavaskeitia, who is a news reporter at independent.ie, and Peter Leonard, barrister and presenter of Fifth Court Ireland's legal podcast, to discuss all of the stories making the news today. And the texts come in, continue to come in, and thank you very much for them if you sent one in relation to what people saw in polling stations. Separate point on polling stations, says a text. The challenge to us, let me just get this. Yeah, couldn't find ours as we're new to the area. Tried Googling it, but got a school 100 kilometres away and got there, but there was no polling station sign on the road entrance, just one in the front door of the school behind another building. Anyway, finally got there. Another, I was out and about at a social event yesterday, didn't meet one person who was voting yes. It'll be such an obvious no-no that the result will be very quick from the tallies. Another, like your previous texter, I was not happy or not completely understanding of the wording, so I voted no. I was not likely to ignore the advice of Senators Michael McDougall and Tom Clonan. Another, 30% turnout? Well, steady. That's, we are at straw poll stuff in the turnout. We don't yet know, but early suggestions seem that it's in and around that range. 30% turnout, what does that tell you? Will carers' lives be better? Will anything change? No, it's not important. It's a total waste of time and money. Plus, they shut the primary schools, causing hardship for some parents trying to find childcare. Gabia, this all seems to be going well.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the, you know, even certainly some of the texts that you're reading out there, people would indicate like they don't really know what the referendums are about. They don't really know why they're on. And like that was clear weeks and months ago. And I don't think any of the discourse that we've seen in recent days from government ministers, indeed the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, I don't think they've clarified a lot of those issues. And I think that's why we're seeing that low turnout.
Is that a function of them not doing a good job? Or is that a function of the Constitution being somewhat esoteric and philosophical by design, and therefore it's hard to be specific?
Sure. I mean, look, if you look at previous referendums, for example, marriage equality, I mean, that's a very straightforward issue that people, you know, usually feel one way or another about, or perhaps they come in somewhere in the middle. You know, the abortion referendum obviously is much more complex, but it evokes all these emotions in people and they are much more likely to get into a debate. And there wasn't really a debate around these ones. You know, this sense of what a family is and this durable relationship, like, okay, maybe people kind of understand that. I'd say most people would agree that we should take out certain clauses of our constitution that, you know, ministers have said are sexist towards women. But then this care amendment that was coming in, you know, people weren't very on board with that. They didn't really understand, well, what does it mean if we do put it in? Does that mean that carers are going to get more supports in the budget, for example, as Social Protection Minister Heather Humphreys indicated earlier in the week? So because it wasn't so clear cut, there wasn't really a debate. It's hard to get people on board. But that's the government's job. I mean, they're the ones that are bringing forward the referendum. So if you want people to vote, if you want them to have their say, then it's up to you to explain it clearly. And when you have, in fairness, Michael McDougall and some of the other no actors who have been received a lot of media attention and coverage in recent days and weeks, you know, when they're saying this is going to mean trouble for your family farm, your family business, your property, people are saying, well, do you know what? Like that makes me worried and I don't know who to believe now.
Well, it's interesting as you are talking, a text came in saying if the vote, and by the way, I should say, we could discover in an hour or two that it is an overwhelming landslide yes vote. We do not yet know. But a text saying, if the vote goes against the yeses today, we will be told it was too complicated for simple minds. But the fault lies with the rush and the wording and not with the voters. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. And an interesting one, Peter, from you might have a view on is, how often your colleague in the law library is getting mentioned as a factor in this. I voted no. Michael McDougall's pieces in media convinced me. And it was 2 weeks ago on this show, he said, this will be the Senate referendum again. It'll start off as a strong yes. And by the time people go to the polls, it'll be a no.
Yeah, I think Michael McDougall has been a major factor in it. As you say, Anton, it's too early yet to predict how it's going to go. But it does sound like there's a bit of confusion out there. He came out very strongly at the start, and has been the main player, I think, all along. And then there's been kind of supporting players as well. And on the other side, it was the government who were required to push this. Now, I think the government, they felt, as Gabia talked about marriage equality referendum, the abortion referendum, Ireland seems to be going in one direction. And this was an attempt to take antiquated language out of the constitution. It was drafted back in 1937. It's a different Ireland now, so our understanding of the family might be slightly different now. The role of women in the home, to use that cliche in relation to that provision. I think the government just automatically assumed that people would move in that direction and take it out. But then you got the likes of Michael McDougall and you got...
But hang on a minute, did they then put jam on it with what they were putting in? If the offer had just been, we'll take out the antiquated language and delete the provision, would they have had an easier time of the campaign?
Yes. Well, I think probably that would have been, you know, an easier solution. Just take out that reference to women specifically and you could take that provision out. Though the feeling was, I think, that there was, you know, that you should acknowledge the role of carers in the home. So I think there was some sort of decent aspirational thinking behind it. But you have to sell it to people. And when the language is confusing and when people don't really know what it's about, then those that are opposed to it can sort of, you know, suggest that this is very confusing. And when people are confused, they tend to kind of stay with the status
quo. Although what's interesting is, and a text saying, my husband and I voted in two separate polling stations in Portlaoise, surprisingly brisk at both polling stations at 7:30 last night. There was a sense yesterday that nobody was going to come out, that the picture of Michael D. Higgins voting might be the only person who actually cast a ballot in this thing. And it looks like the turnout, by comparison to the paucity of turnouts that some referendums have generated, ain't too bad.
Well, I voted at 8:30 last night and I just asked them, I said, what's the turnout like? And they estimated at the little booth I was at that it was about 45%. So there will be areas in the country where people come out. But I do think those that are opposed, the motivation to come out is stronger. I think the public at large, generally, if you ask them about it, they might be generally supportive of it. But those that really feel strongly about it, they will get out. So the fact that it's a low turnout, I think, favours potentially a no vote, but we don't know.
Would you buy that, Gabia? Because in previous referendums, there is a sort of a truism that says, well, if you get a big turnout, it skews liberal. It's very hard to figure out where liberal is in this one, because a lot of people who would quote themselves as liberal are voting on both sides of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think we really have to sit on our laurels and see how the next couple of hours go. I think that sometimes if people maybe disagree with something, they might just say, I'm not going to bother voting, which is not necessarily how it works. I mean, it's whatever the majority vote is. I also want to make the point that, you know, whatever is the result of the referendums today, the referendums are being seen as more or less a confidence vote in the government. And ministers, and especially the heads of government, are going to be keeping a very close eye on the voter turnout, what's the breakdown in the vote in different parts of the country. Because if both of the referendums passes, that's great news for the government. That means that the public, you know, say, yes, of course, we'll make these constitutional amendments. They were a good idea and we're voting yes. If one of them falls, it means that public support for the government is iffy. If both of them fall, I think the coalition could find itself in a serious bout of trouble. Of course, we are expecting a general election.
Though, because if you go back to the Senate referendum, the Senate referendum defeat, the government stepped over its corpse and walked on like it was nothing.
Yes, but it's a different time now. We are seeing unprecedented support for Sinn Féin. We're seeing Sinn Féin that are in government in the north, with the first minister ever, which is a Sinn Féin deputy leader. So, like, the government is looking at elections which are probably going to, you know, result in very good results for Sinn Féin. They're going to take a lot of seats, be it in the locals, be it in the generals, be it perhaps even in Europe as well. So the trick for Leo Varadkar here is to say, OK, at what point do I call the general election? Because if I do call an election this year, which what a lot of us expect, maybe he doesn't say that same publicly, but that's what, you know, people in Leinster House certainly expect. He has to really get the timing right and go to the country at when support for the government is at its highest.
Go ahead, Peter.
No, just one point in relation to that. Obviously, if the referendums fail today, that is not good because the government are out of touch with the public mood. But I think it's quite significant, Anton. I mean, if those referendums fail today, that means that Ireland is accepting in its constitution the notion of a family being the traditional ma and pa and kids. and we're rejecting the notion that a family is in a wider context. I think it's quite significant if Ireland decides that. And also,
yeah, I wonder
in relation
what that
to
gall
this,
people. Will people say, no, I'm not accepting the status quo, but I prefer it to the alternative that I was given to change the status quo.
Okay, but I mean, like, are we saying that we're going to keep that in our constitution? This was drafted by De Valera all those years ago, 1937, and we're saying that's the idea of a family. And I'm not trying to get into the politics of it, but I'm just saying, is this something that will have to? Will we have to have another go? Will this be Lisbon Mark II, Maastricht Mark II? I don't know.
But internationally, makes us look, I suppose, kind of backwards, because recently we have taken very liberal stances on issues such as abortion and marriage equality as well. So if now, you know, because internationally it will be reported as, you know, Ireland had an opportunity to remove this archaic and quote-unquote sexist part of the constitution and actually said, no, we're going to keep it. So how does that make us look on the world
stage?
Well,
you'll be glad to know that everybody is disagreeing with everything, because we're now getting texts in to say, that's rubbish. I have total confidence in the government, but I still voted no in both referendums. Then another, I was a strong yes in the marriage equality and abortion vote. I voted no yesterday. I wasn't confused. And please don't say I was. Another, am I taking crazy pills? I don't consider myself that intelligent. But how was the referendum that confusing? How was the ballot question vague? The info posted was clear. And how hard is it to understand that you mark a cross in the box of your choice? Again, I'm just citing what is coming in. An awful lot of people saying that they found both the referendum campaigns and the question that they were asked on the ballot confusing. Should constitutional amendments really be made on such low turnout, asks another. We will return to this as we begin to get a sense of what is emerging from boxes around the country. If you have a view or if you have a feedback on turnout, 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp. I want to move to the story of the analysis that was done. We have the interim report, the interim Canova report done by John Boucher, the PSNI man, formerly UK police, who has spent, I think the bill runs to something like 40 million at this point, in 7 years doing a review of the efficacy of a steak knife, the informer within the IRA, and all that went around it, and the actions of the security services and the actions of the provisional IRA. To some extent, this is a bit like the Moriarty Tribunal report, where it is so detailed and so long that it is easy to lose the thrust of it because it runs to 208 total pages. But there is a piece within it that I wanted to get a view on, because Michelle O'Neill issued an apology yesterday. And the apology was a sort of a, maybe I do it a disservice, but it was a generalized apology to all of those who had been impacted by either side of the combat in the Troubles. The apology was requested in the report, and it was requested from senior provisional IRA leadership, where the Boucher says they should be eager, they should find a way to, without further delay, acknowledge the crimes, the impact their crimes had on the victims, and issue a public apology. And he says in the report that the Provisional IRA used torture, inhumane behaviour and murder as a deterrent against people working with the security forces. It was often unconcerned as to the factual or actual involvement of its victims in assisting the security forces. Strategically and fundamentally, what it was doing was about deterrence. Typically, the PIRA did not live up to undertakings given to people to, this is where he's talking about getting confessions, and executed many of those who made admissions in a vain attempt to stay alive, not necessarily because they had assisted the security forces in any way. Some in the Republican movement consider these activities legitimate acts of warfare. They were not. The Republican leadership gave carte blanche to their internal security unit to commit acts of torture and murder, and there was no internal accountability whatsoever. In the context of that, Michelle O'Neill's apology, Peter.
Well, you know, I mean, I suppose Michelle O'Neill is going to say, well, this is now, and that was then. I mean, I think when she apologises, I mean, I think you have to say that it's a genuine apology. I mean, I think this is just horrific. I mean, this is, we look back in the Troubles, I mean, it was such a dark period. And as we move on, I mean, sometimes these become less clear and it becomes a little bit murky and it goes into the past.
But let me cite you another bit. There's a bit of this which gives some fair clarity. You're talking about people who might have been innocent of the charges that the IRA put against them. And they said not only did their families lose loved ones, they faced humiliation and violence themselves. These family members were entirely innocent of any wrongdoing on anyone's interpretation of events. This intimidation and violence included acts against children, those with known learning difficulties, and the elderly.
No, it's horrific.
When families sought to grieve and bury their loved ones, they were mocked and further intimidated.
Well, that's it. And I mean, the notion of the informer in Ireland, it has always been there, going back to the good old days and going back centuries. And obviously, this was a horribly dirty war and things happened and then people took sides. And if you were deemed to be dealing with the other side, it was a slur on families in Republican areas. There's no doubt about that. And it was horrific. And we have this guy, Steak Knife, who can't be named in the report, which is still kind of shocking. And we see that there are still walls being put up by MI5 where they won't allow certain information to come out. And I noticed yesterday Chris Heaton Harris wouldn't even give a statement. He said, oh, this is an interim report. We don't comment at this stage yet. So, I mean, there's an awful lot of information that has to come out. Richard O'Rourke, who I've heard on this station being interviewed, I think he was on with Pat yesterday, you know, he's written a book about this. I mean, this is horribly murky. It was vicious. I mean, the Troubles themselves generally were vicious. I mean, I think people should remember that. But I suppose the notion is, ultimately, while these murders were carried out by members of the Provisional IRA and they killed their own, so to speak, the information was coming back to the handlers within the security services within the North, who have an obligation to all citizens to keep them safe. And they, you know, didn't fulfil those obligations. They allowed things to happen. They permitted things to happen for what they would regard as the greater good.
Yes, the report but it wasn't would suggest the that good. They had the capacity
the
to stop murders
that it
wasn't
and did not. Greater good.
Gabia, your reaction to it. I suppose that thing that Peter says about we need to remember, do we? I get the sense from this and from the reaction a lot is we don't want to remember. We just want all this buried and done.
Yeah, and just to touch on those key points of the report, and this is really quite striking. More lives were lost than saved through the British Army's operation of its top agent in the IRA during the Troubles. Also, the report found there will be no criminal charges to anybody in the British side or the IRA side as a result of the report. I mean, how can both of those things can be true at once? And I think when we see those families of IRA, who've lost people during the Troubles, either by the fault of the IRA or the British Army, you know, they haven't got justice in any of this. And I mean, that's really the point of all this, is that people were killed needlessly. They lost their lives. Some of them were extremely young, that were involved in the conflict, as Sinn Féin calls it. And like, as a result of that, there's no justice for them. You know, Michelle O'Neill, I thought she spoke quite well yesterday. She's saying she's sorry for all of the lives lost during our conflict. I think if she is going to be an effective First Minister for all, as she calls herself, she is going to have to be much more upfront about the atrocities of the IRA and say, this is our conflict, as she rightfully called it yesterday, and to, you know, really be genuinely apologetic for what happened.
But it's interesting to see in the report, I mean, Badger goes so far as to say that this isn't even fully in the past. He says in it, I appeal for everyone to stop labelling, and this is in reference to people who are in many instances innocent of the charges that even the IRA laid at them. I appeal for everyone to stop labelling, accusing, belittling and intimidating the families of those the IRA murdered because of often incorrect accusations. The next generation has done nothing to deserve the treatment to which some are still subjugated. These families have done nothing wrong.
Yes, and young people, I think nowadays, you know, who are sort of were born post the Troubles and who didn't grow up seeing the Troubles unfold on television, they don't really have an understanding of how horrific it truly was during that very, very dark time in the North. And I think that's what some of the fear is amongst some of the older generations, is that when we talk about this unity pole or perhaps a United Ireland, like, what does that mean in terms of the Troubles, and could it see a return? That is the fear that some people have. I don't know how true it is or how likely that is actually to transpire. But like, if you do you know, literally any research. And recently, for my own sins, when I was in school, I was even talking to my friends about this last night. I didn't really get any education on the Troubles or what went on in the North. I knew all about the famine. I knew all about the plantations. But when it came to things that happened literally not even 100 years ago in this country that I live in, I didn't really have much of an idea. So recently I have been doing a lot of research and reading up on it, prompted in some ways by Aoife Moore's book on Sinn Féin, which is very insightful, I thought. But, you know, it's horrendous to read. I mean, like, you know, that even that case of Yvonne Dunlop, who was a young mother who had lost her life by that soldier, Thomas McIlwainy. You know, she got blown up and well, that was it. There's no justice there, you know.
If you do want to read the entire document, kenova.co.uk, it is 200 pages. It is a heavy read. It is nonetheless a very revealing read. We will move on to other things. First of all, Peter, this is one that I would like your view on, given your legal training. I realise your specialism may not be employment law, but it nonetheless. Dee Forbes, never going to face grilling on the RTE crisis. This is according to the Irish Independent. Her lawyers have been in touch with the Public Accounts Committee to say she is getting ongoing medical care and will never be in a position where she's going to be able to appear in front of the RTE. What do you do with that precedent?
Well, I think it's a strange statement. I mean, at the end of the day, we do operate humanely in the sense that if somebody is, you know, medically incapable of attending at a tribunal, I mean, the courts are always kind of going to give some sort of leeway in relation to that, but it has to be substantiated. Anton, you mean you have to produce proper medical evidence. In this instance, this is now what I'm going on, that I'm hearing from the papers, is that, you know, solicitors are contacting and saying, no, medically she's not fit. And if you need us to show you the medical evidence, we'll send that on. I would have thought the medical evidence should go ahead of the solicitor.
Although presumably her solicitors would argue that they have a duty of care to protect her medical privacy. And unless absolutely necessitated by the committee, they don't want to be passing on medical records if they can avoid it.
Yeah, but those medical records will not be displayed. I mean, they are for, you know, the chairman of the committee. I think it's a chairman in this instance, Brian Stanley. Or it's the media, so it's Niamh Smith, sorry. She can look at this and she can say, actually, I've looked at this and, yeah, I'm happy that, you know, she's established the position that she's not in a position to attend. Is it the case that she'll never, ever be able to attend? I mean, I wish her well. I hope there isn't, you know, a medical condition that will deny her the opportunity of speaking publicly about something she was involved in.
It's a tricky one for the committees, though. What do you do in future if you discover somebody who is at the heart of a national scandal is too ill to attend your committee on a permanent basis? It's a very difficult precedent, isn't it?
It's a very difficult precedent. And, I mean, they have given options. I mean, they've talked about, you know, she can contact them by video link. She doesn't have to be present.
Or
that might make it easier.
Response.
Yeah, and even give a written response. Like, one has to take things at face value and one has to accept if she's too unwell to attend, fair enough. But, I mean, how do you look beyond that, as you say? How do you look behind it? Because committees have to be effective. She is a central player in relation to this. I mean, for herself, it must be very painful all the time. When's she going to turn up? When's she going to turn up? When's she going to turn up? I'm a great believer in get out straight away, day one, and do what you can and address whatever the issue is and then move on. And I mean, people are actually very sympathetic. I think, you know, people will listen to the story. The story moves on. When you don't turn up, when, you know, there's speculation and when, why isn't she turning up, all that sort of stuff, it just gives rise to more and more speculation. Mm. And that has to be very, very difficult for somebody who has a medical condition that is denying her the opportunity to speak. So it's kind of like a vicious circle. I think it's very difficult for her.
There's also an interesting breakdown inside the Mail on the broader implications of this whole scandal, because they've done a look at how the licence fee is going in terms of collecting or revenue for the organisation. The summary answer is badly. Mm-hmm. The funding crisis for RTE gets ever and ever deeper. Final thing before we wrap up, Gabia, did you happen to watch President Joe Biden's State of the Union address?
I didn't when it was live, but I did catch up on it this morning. Keith Duggan writing in the Irish Times saying that, you know, Sleepy Joe is nowhere to be seen and he's very energised. And in fairness, Joe Biden was very energised during the State of the Union speech. You know, much applause. And I think from obviously the Democratic parts of Congress. And, you know, it's very much so that, isn't our president great? We're going to stand up every 2 minutes and clap for him. And I think that's a good look for him. I think that's what they needed at this point in the game.
Well, we have a little clip because it is very different to the Joe Biden that we have heard in recent months.
Not since President Lincoln and the Civil War our freedom and democracy have been under assault at home as they are today. What makes our moment rare is that freedom and democracy are under attack at both at home and overseas. This is the moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Those bragging about overturning Roe v. Wade have no clue about the power of women. But they found out when reproductive freedom was on the ballot. We won in 2022 and 2020, and we'll win again in 2024.
Yes, full of energy there, and he sounds in top form. And I think the challenge for Joe Biden now is going to have to be sustaining that top form right up until November. I will say, someone's State of Union speech that I did watch is independent candidate in the presidential elections, Robert F. Kennedy, of the Kennedy family, of course, and Anton is squirming in his seat. But I actually thought it was interesting to hear what he had to say, making very much to the points that wasn't America great back when JFK was president and now everything's terrible. I don't know how true that is, but it was different to get a little bit of a different perspective. He's an independent candidate, so he hasn't got an earshot of going near the White House. But it's interesting to see how the Kennedy family keeps on trying to get back in there.
Gabia, thank you very much. Likewise, thank you very much to Peter Leonard. That is Peter Leonard, barrister and presenter of the Fifth Court, Ireland's legal podcast. And Gabia Gadavaskeitia, who is news reporter at independent.ie.
The Anton Savage Show, Saturday.
With Nifty Business.
Saturday morning at 9. On News Talk.